Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discover that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. You're over the road. You don't want to deal with the call process. Maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password. Therefore, you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But can we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you file board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, Martin, thank you so very, very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a terrific crowd here tonight. PJ, I want you to understand that we have people here that were invited from calls that we took this past Sunday with regards to another issue where I shared with them the Corporation Soul and Charitable Religious Trust, the benefits of it. And then I told them about how this call on Tuesday night would be able to share with them how jurisdiction is in place to defend against assaults, against the trusts, and against the corporation's soul. So with that in mind, I want to go ahead and share some court cases with everyone on the call, and we'll start with that, and then we'll hopefully bring up questions after PJ shares and elaborates on what I'm about to share with you. Now, when the IRS comes after you for any particular reason with a claim that you owe them for taxes, their legal authority to operate is internal. That's why they're called the Internal Revenue Service. It's internal to the United States government. And that is under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of our federal constitution. That is 10 miles within the seat of power, all territories, all possessions, and all enclaves. Now, if you live in Texas, Texas is one of the several states within the freely associated compact states that is part of the original assembly of the several states, the union, if you would. But on the other hand, the state of Texas is a federal territory. It has the same physical dimensions. It's a layer right above the ground, but it's not the ground itself. And when I read the following court cases to you, when I say you grasp what I just said about having Texas, and it could be California and the state of California. It could be Massachusetts and the state versus the state of California, state of Massachusetts. One is one of the sovereign several states, and the other is a territory of the United States by a very similar name. In Maxwell versus Dow, it says in part, quote, the privileges, it didn't say the rights, it said the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the first 8 amendments to the federal constitution against the powers of the federal government. So right here, they're talking about one group of people that have privileges and another group of people that have rights. I bet you didn't know there were two groups of people here under the term United States citizen. U.S. versus Valentine, the only, Now, that's singular. Now, we know about the Bill of Rights. There's originally 10 Bill of Rights, and then it's gone on from there. But the Bill of Rights itself is 10, that's 10 amendments to the Constitution, 10 Bill of Rights. But here it says the only absolute right. That's singular. An unqualified right, the only absolute and unqualified right of a United States citizen is to residence, that's a legal term, within the territorial boundaries of the United States. So if you're in Florida, one of the several states, that's one thing. But if you're in the state of Florida, which is, we said it earlier, is a territory, then that is the territorial boundary, one of the territorial boundaries of the United States. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, quote, therefore, the United States citizen, open bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing in one of the states of the Union. See, they're exercising that single right, not from the creator of the universe, but from the Congress. They only have that one right, and that is to reside in one of the several states of the Union. They're classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity, end quote. When was the last time you heard that flesh and blood men and women were property? Yeah, before the Civil War. They were slaves. They came from Africa. Well, they came from Ireland, believe it or not. The first slaves in the colonies were Irishmen from their prisons and from their poverty. But they didn't work out so well in the heat of the South, so someone else had to come up that was accustomed to heavier work, and that was the people from Africa. But they were slaves. They were property of people. Here in Wheeling Steel Corporation, it says that the U.S. citizen, being specifically the District of Columbia, which would by extension be all territories, possessions, and enclaves, reside, key word from before in the other court case, it's unique, legal term, in one states of the Union, they're identifying the several free states, if you would. They're classified as property and franchises of the United States government. Hendricks versus Maryland, a U.S. citizen, upon leaving the District of Columbia. There we go again. They're not talking about the several states. They're talking about the District of Columbia, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution. A U.S. citizen, upon leaving the District of Columbia, becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident, again, and does not have the common law right to travel of one of the several citizens of one of the several states. How many times has a blue light ever gone on in your back, in your rearview mirror, and the policeman asks for your driver's license? A driver's license is a privilege, but here it talks about the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states. Do you see the two different entities at play? City of Dallas versus Mitchell. The rights of the individuals, and individuals is, again, a legal term for a federal citizen. They're restricted only to the extent that they've been voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship of the several states to the agencies of government. When you go to the government and ask for permission to do something, get a hunting license, get a fishing license, get a marriage license, get a driver's license, get a pilot's license, you're asking them for permission to do what is already a natural right. And while we're talking about that, look at Wadley versus Newell. I had a conversation with a gentleman today. He was American of African descent. And I asked him, was Martin Luther King right when he marched for civil rights? The gentleman said, yes, of course. And I said, no. Civil rights is something that came into being for those people who were slaves by way of the 13th Amendment became free, and by the way of the 14th Amendment became under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Federal Constitution. And they changed from being property to being people who could be sued, persons who could be sued and sue people. That's what that enabled them to do. And it says here that you gave up that right when you entered into commerce as a resident. The rights of the individuals are restricted only to the fact that you gave up your rights when you began asking for permission. Wadley versus Newell, again, civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens, as parents, have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount state, end quote. When did a parent give up their rights to their children? When they decided to become federal citizens and have civil rights. Well, what are the other rights that we have? When the federal citizen, when the former slaves became United States citizens, 14th Amendment citizens, for the entire time of their life, they needed the 14th Amendment to have civil rights, which were equal rights to those of natural rights. But when the last former slave died, so if this is 1868, let's say they lived to 100, somebody lives to 100 years old, that's 1968. Let's give them another 10 years just to make sure everybody's died off. Let's go to 100, let's go to 1978. After 1978, there was not a single American of African descent that required civil rights to operate in the United States. Why? Because everyone born after the 14th Amendment, after 1868, those people, Americans of African descent, were citizens of the state upon the land was on which they were born. They had a birthright. See, the slaves before had no birthright in the United States, but their children, after the 14th Amendment, their children were born on the land of within one of the freely associated compact states, and they had natural rights. The government has been lying to us all along, convincing us that we have civil rights, and totally ignoring our natural rights. And who gives us the civil rights? It's not from the creator of the universe. Civil rights come from the Congress. So, with that having been said, hopefully enough to confuse everyone at this point to at least invite you to ask questions. And then to understand how if any of the trusts and or the corporation soul that you acquire from Bernie ever comes under attack, remember, they have never come under attack in the 27 years that Bernie has processed over 5,000 people, helping them get their corporation soul, their trust. It's never been assaulted. But should it come under attack? Should they come under attack? Because there's never been this kind of money on the table before. Should they come under attack? And frankly, I expect them to come under attack. You're going to hear from a gentleman tonight that is prepared with his team to come in through your trust as a special agent with limited powers of attorney to deal as a non-attorney without the allegiance to the, as an officer of the court, without the allegiance to the bar association that attorneys have, without the concerns about their livelihood because they've upset the courts and upset the bar association, these men and women come in, as Thomas Jefferson said, knowledgeable in the law and well disposed to using it. You're going to hear from PJ tonight how this basic question of jurisdiction comes into play each and every time and is the remedy, your remedy, that is in the law. PJ?
Thank you. Yeah, it's very interesting. There's been several times when we've had trust issues, and the opposing party's attorney immediately runs in front of the judge and says, oh, they can't have a non-attorney representing this trust.
PJ, his call just dropped. Let me, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, excuse us. PJ just dropped off the call. He's probably still talking to us, thinking that he's got us here. Let me try to bring him in real quick on a separate call. I'm sorry. I just heard him drop. Looked up, and there he's gone. It dropped. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay, I've got everyone back here again. PJ, you're three-wayed in. I don't know what happened on your end, but we got you now. Go ahead.
What were you saying? Okay. You can hear me now?
Yeah, hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm still muted on that other call. Okay. I don't think I muted it at all. But
no, you dropped from the other call, PJ. I brought you in on a conference line.
Oh, okay, that explains it. Okay, starting over. Once upon a time. Anyway, recently we've had situations where we have a established trust gets challenged by the IRS or the property taxes or other things. And the opposing party runs to the judge, tries to shouts foul, and says that all entities have to be represented by a state licensed bar attorney, and that PJ is not a state licensed bar attorney. So what we do is we go back in and we show them the characteristics of the trust. The trust clearly communicates that it's non-statutory. It has no affiliation with the state. It is a creation, but it's not a creation of the United States, or it's not a creation of any of the individual states under the statehood of the United States, I guess, if I wanted to say it. So it's independent of the United States. So now, if the United States did create a trust, then they can make the rules for that trust. But in the trust that we deal with, they're developed by the individual, and he has a right to do so. They have a right to put their assets in trust on the statutory side. If they have that right, how in the world do they take that right away from us? They can't do it. One of our most important things that we focus on, especially recently, is that we're able to go in and show the judge. These judges, a great many of these judges know that something's going south in this country. They really, a lot of them have trouble figuring out exactly what it is. And we explain to them that the founding fathers knew, by studying history, what caused the nation to go awry. And it's the removal of individual man's rights. No man has a right to violate another man's rights. And, so very simple. You do the right thing at all times and things will go quite well. So we don't have to have a legislative body or a police state or anything like that making sure that everything is right. First of all, they don't have the authority. The only authority that the United States has, the Constitution actually tells us, by the consent of the government. There's certain things that you don't want to do. And you can absolutely consent the government do that for you. you don't want to build a bridge over the Missouri River, so you consent the government to do that for you. You participate in paying for it, and you know, everybody benefits. One individual's not going to get the bridge built, but millions of individuals working together build a pretty nice bridge. And very economically for everybody. So that is the principle here, that you have a right to have this form of trust that Michael has been speaking about tonight. And they have a terrible time governing that trust. They can't govern. The only area they can govern that trust in is where it's violating another man's right. We make sure that we don't do anything to do that. We don't use these trusts to evade taxes. We don't use these trusts to hide assets from ongoing established court judgments. Now, if a court judgment is in existence before the trust that established, the trust isn't going to help you. But if the product, if these assets are placed in the trust prior to the initiation of a, let's just say, a federal IRS case, then they have a horrible time tapping into taking the assets for themselves. So that is tremendous value at times. I personally don't really need a trust that much because I can perform quite well in court myself, and I actually ask them to bring it on. And for the last 40 years, I've asked the IRS to bring the information in, evidence in that I have a legal duty to file and an amount due and owing. And they used to hurt.
PJ? Okay, well, the problem is on PJ's end. He obviously has a poor connection where he's at. I don't know that I can bring him back in. I hope he calls back in. The what you heard PJ talk about was two things. One is not having trusts, etc., still is not a problem for people who have a problem with the IRS. He looks forward to having the IRS contact him about the money that he makes and things like that because he wants to go to court. He's comfortable going to court, not just for you, but for himself as well. And this comfort is a situation where the law is always on the side of a citizen within the freely associated states, compact states. The law is not on the side of federal citizens. The federal citizens have a duty to keep records and pay taxes for the federal government. Federal citizens have that duty. The federal government presumes you are a federal citizen. And what PJ's work does and his associates is that he makes them delineate between federal citizens and state citizens. State citizens are not required to pay the federal tax, income tax. They're not required. Federal citizens are. The land upon which state citizens sojourn, walk around, is not federal land and is not subject to federal laws. There was an abortion clinic that was in, I think it was Detroit, and this is going back into the early 1990s or maybe even late 1980s. And at that time, if you all remember, they used to have what was called a bubble zone around the abortion clinic so that people who were there to give sidewalk counseling to the young women going into the abortion clinic, showing them what a child looks like at 12 weeks old, you know, at 18 weeks old, et cetera, how, you know, developed they are and so forth, trying to change these women's minds. There was this bubble zone, and it was a federal law, and these street counselors violated this bubble zone. They were arrested. Six of them were arrested. And when they went to court, five of them had attorneys. One of them did not. And as it worked out in the sequence of things, the one that did not have an attorney was always placed last in the how do you plead portion of the first appearance of the court action. Five of them had attorneys, and they had all sorts of plea agreements that they were trying to make, et cetera, to mitigate the sentencing and so forth. But the sixth man said, Your Honor, when did, and he named the physical location of that property that was deemed the bubble zone. He said, when did the city of Detroit cede, when did the state of Illinois cede that land to the federal government? And he said, they never have that I know of. And they turned to the prosecutor and says, do you know if the federal government, if this state has ever ceded this land to the federal government to the prosecutor? And he says, no, it's never ceded. And he goes, Your Honor, how can I be charged a federal crime on state land? And his charges were dropped. And, of course, the other five attorneys are sitting there with their jaws on the floor, and they're now scrambling to try to rearrange things, which they did. And it ended up all six people had their criminal charges dropped against them because they weren't on federal land. And it took a pro per man standing in his own right in the courtroom to show the attorneys about jurisdiction. These are the things that PJ operates with. And it's not just PJ, he's just the point of the spear. There's several people behind him. And again, even though there has never been a case that have come against any of the trusts that Bernie operates, generates as a court order, not one, not even inquiries, never mind a court case developing from it. I do expect post-RV that or post-Michael G. event, I do very well expect that the cockroaches will come out and brave the light of day regardless in an attempt to steal the money. And I wanted you to hear from PJ that there is defenses in place that he's able to segue into your trust with your permission. You have to sign for it, actually. You have to put it in there. That he has the limited powers of attorney to defend the trust. I'm going to pause for a second, and I'm going to try to reach him again on the phone. And bear with me, please, for just a moment. We'll have some silence. I'll be right back, hopefully. Can you back in?
Tell me where I quit talking.
It's all right. You back here, PJ? You here?
Yeah, but where did I end up? How long have
I? Well, I've covered a lot of ground since then. The thing that I'm the group you're talking to tonight, PJ, uniquely are these people who either have already acquired a charitable religious trust, a few of them a corporation sold through Judge Bernie for events that are going to bring a financial windfall to them. If it comes to them directly under their Social Security number, they will have, without other arguments, they will have a duty to pay 37% to the federal government. But if they operate through a corporation sole, a charitable religious trust specifically, then that EIN number is deemed by the IRS as a non-taxpayer, and everything should be fine. It's been fine for 27 years operating in this fashion through the trusts. Now, I have been saying that there's never been this kind of money that will be on the table post-event. And when that money's on the table, even the cockroaches that only come out at night when you can't see them to attack, they will come out and brave the light of day to go after the tens of millions of dollars that will be out there through these events and through the global currency resets and so forth. So I wanted them to hear from you how definitive and how powerful it is for you to step in, not being an officer of the court, not being a member of the bar, not having a job relating on that depended upon keeping the courts and the bar association happy with you, and how you can how you are able to walk into the courtroom as a defender of the trust when necessary. You do most every 99% of everything you do by paperwork anyways, but how you can do that. So that's what I wanted you to elaborate on. I also shared with everybody that some of the information providers we have, like Brother John and so forth, they have gone to law school, they've graduated from law school, they get their Juris Doctorate, their JD, and they've even passed the bar. They just refuse to become a bar member, enabling them to exercise their knowledge through the vehicle of either being a special agent to a trust, or by the fact that an association of people may have one of the members of that association step forward in court and present for them, regardless of the fact that they're not even attorneys. So I wanted the people on this call to understand that you're there to help, and I'd like you to talk about that, how you're available to provide, and your team.
Sure, sure. Yeah, if you're ever attacked for anything associated with that trust, I simply act as a trustee, and I respond to and interact with the opposing party. The number one thing that these guys do is they try their hardest to get the plaintiff or the defendant in a case to take on an attorney. Because once they get that attorney in place, then they've got tremendous control over the entire case, because the attorney is generally 99% of the time going to bow to the judge. And if the judge calls him into the chambers, which they do, we've had attorneys come and tell us this on a regular basis, the judge calls him into the chambers and tells him how to basically throw the case without making it look like he's doing it intentionally. So if you take on an attorney and it's a state interest, and I believe me, income tax, state income tax, federal income tax, state interest, that they will do everything they can to try to get you to bring on a state bar attorney so that you can virtually be guaranteed to lose your case. And that's where I come in. We have jurisdictional challenges that we can bring in to stop them from basically stealing from your trust, because you have that trust has a right. And if, for example, if you make $100 a day and you have no nexus with the state, you're not working under a state license, you're not working in state land, you're not working under state contract, you don't have a state nexus. You don't have a state business relationship or association. They have no authority for any taxation, for any obligation, for any filing from you, or any payment from you. Now, we never say that we never have the obligation to file. We never have an obligation to pay. Burden of proof on them entirely, because it's paid if you don't. But a lot of people, they might have 20 years of studying the law, and they are a catastrophe in court, because all they want to do is get in the court, tell the judge how much they know, tell the jury how much they know, and it's the worst thing we can do. The jury just sits back and rolls their eyes. You don't have any evidence to support what you're saying, and you lose your case. But anyway, the number one thing is that we can go in there. This is not our first rodeo. This is our 10,000th rodeo. We've gone in many, many times under the same situation, know exactly what they're doing. Or we shouldn't say we know exactly what we're doing, but we know that there's only so many ways you can play a chess game. There might be millions of different ways to do it, but there's only so many ways. and you can track their moves, and that's what we do. They try to come into the back door, the side door, the window, all kinds of ways to throw your case. We go right back to the fundamental principle that they have to prove that that trust does not have standing as a right and independent of the United States, the state, the city, and the county, and so forth. So that's how, if they don't have any evidence that the income was domestically earned in the inland of the United States, they don't have a nexus for taxation. And we keep the burden of proof on
that. And that's in addition to and over and above the fact that this is a ecclesiastical or a church trust, having nothing to do with the civil law, admiralty law, common law, chancery law, or any other fathom of law. This is church law. And like we said on the call on Sunday night and on Saturday night, unless you commit a crime, which is a civil offense, they have no way to egress into the trust, period. And the IRS has no interest in coming into the trust unless you mingle funds, which is something we'll talk about on the other calls on Saturday with Bernie. But let's open it up for Q&A, PJ. How about that?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Okay. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2, and that'll raise your hand on a board that I'm looking at. I'm looking at every one of you here. I've got your phone numbers on the left. Some of you have got your names here. Many people on this call have been here many, many times before. There's a whole lot of new people here as well. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And we're just going to ask PJ some questions, maybe about your case, situations that you're familiar in the past, et cetera. We have a caller coming from Asheboro, North Carolina, ending in 1211. Matt, just your first name only, please. Asheboro, North Carolina, ending in 1211. First name only, please.
Hello?
Yes, there you go. Works to unmute your phone, doesn't it?
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
What's your first name? Jim.
Jim. Thank you, Jim. Welcome to the call.
And thank you for the information you're putting out.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I already have, since 2003, I have a corporation, Soul. It has an apostille and a certification, but I don't know how to use it. Can you help me with that? And or I'd be more than happy to purchase and move and support your activity. Go ahead.
Sure. The first thing that you do, Jim, is to send a copy of the corpus of the corporation Soul to get it in front of Bernie for him to go through it. People think because they get an EIN number that generates a CP575E letter that they're home free, not realizing that that's an automatically generated event if you follow a certain procedure. So if you follow a certain procedure, you're always going to get a CP575E letter, which is identifying the entity as a non-taxpayer to the IRS. Now, if the IRS or anybody ever looks at the corpus of the body of what you were applying the EIN number to, and they find that it is inadequate in law, then it's immediately pierced and it's over with. So we did a thing six years ago, there was an instance where we had the opportunity to gather 48 corporations Soul from 48 people in another large group of people, and they sent their copy of their corporation Soul to Bernie to look at and look through. Of the 48, 46 had multiple fatal flaws within them, where the author of the corporation Soul took the opportunity to use it as a bully pulpit to slander the United States in different places, or just say things that weren't true, and they absolutely would have been pierced any time that they were actually reviewed by a prosecutor or the IRS. So, Jim, I would like very much to have a copy of your corpus of the Corporation Soul. I can share with Bernie, let him go through it, and then he will show you all the good things with it. And prayerfully, it'll be just fine the way it is. And if that's the case, without any cost, we'll be glad to have you join us on our Saturday calls and on our other teaching parts of what we do for Bernie, and bring you right along as if you had purchased it from him. It doesn't matter.
All right.
We're here to support people. We're not here to make a fortune.
Well, I thank you very much. I have not used the Corporation Soul because I didn't know how to use it. The only thing I have is my home and a couple of vehicles, cars in it. The IRS, I've paid my taxes. I have not used the Corporation Soul because I didn't know how to use it. And I would enjoy learning how to help you. You help me to know how to use it. But I have a wonderful Corporation Soul, and I'd be glad to give it to Bernie.
Okay, real good. Everybody, I hope you have something to write with. I'm going to give you a toll-free number to reach out to me. Once we've established contact, I will give you my private cell phone number. And if I'm not on a phone talking to somebody else, I'll always answer your call. If you're ready, it's 1-800-625-4250. Again, that number is 1-800-625-4250. And I'll be glad to respond. And Jim, I hope you wrote that down. Give me a call, and we'll go moving forward. Now, let me just shoot some holes in what you told me. You said you had your house and you had your cars in that Corporation Soul, correct?
That is correct, and I realize that you should not do that. You shouldn't do that.
Right. Right, because what happens, let's say in one of your automobiles, you're involved in an accident.
I understand. If you're in an accident and somebody's injured and they sue the Corporation Soul, everything in the Corporation Soul is liable.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, I never would ever put property in the Corporation Soul. I would have the Corporation Soul be the trustee to individual trusts. Each car would be in its own trust. The house would be in its own trust. For me, the land that the house was built upon would be in a separate trust. Why?
Well, I agree. I'm agreeing with you. I agree. And I hope everybody's listening.
Okay.
I'm asking for help. yes, I agree. You put everything, a car, boat, screwdriver, anything in a different trust, which can be set up, you know, inexpensively. And if you have your car and your house in the same trust or corporation soul, then you're liable for everything within that corporation soul, correct?
Correct. Absolutely. Any other questions, Jim?
No. Thank you for the number. I hope everyone heard it. I hope I offered some insight to everyone listening. And I look forward to some help.
You got it here. All right. Thank you so much, Jim. Appreciate your call. The next is someone from Holbrook, Arizona, ending in 4549. May I have your first name only, please?
Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. May I have your first name, please?
My first name is Sam.
Sam, welcome to the call, Sam. What's your question?
The question I have as far as jurisdiction, earlier in the call, PJ was saying that a person that's born in a state is not a federal citizen. And so my question is, a person that was not born in the United States, but he became a U.S. citizen, or at least, I don't even know how to say that properly, immigrated or came to the United States, and then I was a citizen of the United States. Sure. Do they have a jurisdiction outside the federal?
All right. Let's use this as an example. Let's say someone from Japan immigrates to the United States. They go through the whole process, and there comes to a point where you raise your hand and you pledge allegiance to the United States. Here's the key. There are three definitions to the United States. Three. And I'm going to give them to you right now or in a moment, as soon as I put my fingers on them again. Almost. Here we go. It may be the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. Now, step one. When our forefathers, if you are blessed to be able to trace your genealogy back to 1789, and before and prior to that, you were colonists at one time. Your great grandparents, eight times removed, were colonists. They were property of the king. They were subject to the king. They were on the king's land. They owed the king's rents. They declared their independence. Lexington and Concord followed. There was a protracted war. Right off the bat, we gathered together our founding fathers and formed the Articles of Confederation. When the Articles of Confederation were formed, there was one people and one land divided into 13 units. One people, one land. King George III, through his emissaries, at the end of the struggle, at the end of the fight, in the Treaty of Paris, in the Treaty of Peace, same document, in the first sentence, referred to the former colonists, the former enemy combatants, he referred to them as his peer. What is peer to a king? Another king. So when you talk about that it may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations, those people at that time that fought against King George, King George acknowledged them as sovereign. And in fact, as a group, they were co-sovereigns with one another in this nation. And if your genealogy takes you back to that point in time, by birthright, you are also one of the co-sovereignty. That's the first definition that is in by the Bidwell Court of 1901 and the Hooven Court of 1945, both Supreme Court decisions. It also resulted in the lawful or legal definition found in Black's Law Dictionary's 6th edition. So that's one group of people. They're co-sovereigns. Sovereigns, by the way, are above the law. Second definition. It may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, 6 years after the Articles of Confederation were formed, came into being, 6 years later, the Founding Fathers met in Philadelphia, and they drafted a constitution for the United States of America. And in that constitution, they carved out small pieces of land then. It was 10 miles within the seat of power. We call that Washington, D.C. today. Little Virginia and Maryland, I think, gave up property, ceded property to this entity. Plus, all territories, possessions, and enclaves. Incidentally, just as a sideline, this property, 10 miles, that's a swamp. Washington, D.C. was built on a swamp. The last election talked about draining the swamp. That's literal. It may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. 10 miles in the seat of power, all territories, possessions, and enclaves. That was clearly understood and operated flawlessly until after the Civil War, where the Congress unconstitutionally seized the government of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and created 14th Amendment citizens who are subject, we talked about in another court case, they're property of the United States. And then over a protracted period of time, over the next 45 years, 50 years, through the 1913 Federal Reserve Act. Federal Reserve Act is only for federal citizens, federal land, yet how many of you pay a federal tax? That went on. Then you had the Social Security Act, again, only for federal citizens. And then you have the Buck Act of 1940. That was the coup de grace. That's where they took Florida and then superimposed on top of Florida one of the states within the freely associated compact states, and they created something called the state of Florida. And you went from FLA being the abbreviation for Florida, upper and lower case, to FL, all uppercase. And the state of Florida is a territory of the United States, of which the United States extends its sovereignty over. So everything is predicated upon, at the point of the beginning, or at any point in time after the beginning, you can challenge the land jurisdiction, you can challenge the personam jurisdiction. Definition number three, it may be the collective names of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. The states united by and under the Constitution have their rights enumerated in all of our federal documents, Northwest Ordinance, the Articles of Confederation, a Constitution for the United States of America, our Bill of Rights, all of these speak about our rights from the creator of the universe. The supreme lawgiver is one of the phrases that our founding fathers used. Versus federal citizens only enjoy, remember, a single right, and that is to live among the free men and women within the freely associated compact states. The federal government always asserts that you are a federal citizen. Without ever saying it, they assert that. And they will go through every, including the judge, who's supposed to be impartial, every length that they can to trick you into confessing yourself being a federal citizen. Just a simple question. Well, Mr. Smith, where do you reside?
Oh, I reside at 123 Main Street, Attleboro, Massachusetts.
Oh, great. I have jurisdiction then. Because a resident, remember I told you that was a key word? The resident is somebody who is domiciled in Washington, D.C., but lives amongst the free people within the freely associated compact states. Does that help you out, Sam?
I'm understanding that, but the practicality of it, I guess, is the difficult part to understand. And
Here's the practicality of it. Your Honor, I'm here for first appearance. I'm here to plead guilty, not guilty, etc. But there's a problem. The state, the prosecutor over there, has yet to establish on the record the land jurisdiction that this alleged action, crime, issue, infraction, whatever, took place. Is it the land within the freely associated compact states, or is it the land that's federal territory? Until the prosecutor establishes this, there's no foundation in law that I may operate. This court cannot operate without knowing that. And the second question is that the prosecutor has yet to evidence, am I a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states, or am I a federal citizen? And then the judge, you know, tries to play his game about your residence and things like that. Do you live in this county? Do you know that county is a definition that shows that it's a subdivision of the United States? Anyways, back to you, Sam.
And so I guess
the question that is in my mind, of course, there's all these other things going on, but if a person is applying, like, say, for a passport, and there's only one question, are you a United States citizen? And if you check that,
does that automatically indicate you're a federal citizen, or does it mean that you're a citizen of...
They didn't stipulate, and you didn't stipulate. So there's no issue there yet, until there's a cause of action. And then the cause of action, at that time, you don't tell them anything. You just ask them where the evidence is regarding one of these three definitions. Then you can move forward.
I appreciate that. That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So if I pledge allegiance to the United States and they tell me that I'm a United States citizen, okay, great. Now, what do you have evidenced upon the record as to which one of these three definitions you think I am? What evidence do you have? Well, you tell us where you reside. Sir, if you don't mind, there's a Fifth Amendment. I don't have to tell you anything. And I'm not. I want to know where the evidence comes forth from the state, from the prosecutor. Until they bring that forth, we can't move forward.
So it's a responsibility of the prosecutor to bring it forth and not to incriminate yourself.
Exactly. When you open your mouth and you start sharing with people how much you know and understand about sovereignty, they're going to nail you. They'll find something to nail you with. Just keep your mouth shut. I don't know nothing, Your Honor. I'm just a dumb person over here. But I know this. I know that there's a land that is the law of the land. So are we looking at the several states within the freely associated compact states, or are we talking about federal land? There's two different jurisdictions. Which one are we operating here? Until they evidence it, we can't move forward.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Sam? Thank you, sir. Appreciate your question, and thank you for coming on our call. Oh, I love this guy. Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
There you go.
I'm here. I had the mute button on. I'm going up and down the road. Hey, life can't get any better than this. I had 42,000 pounds of Jack Daniels going down and 37,000 pounds of cheese coming back. What a combination.
I tell you what. I'd rather have wine and cheese. Never mind.
I hear you. Just checking to see if we've had any follow-up on my paperwork or anything here. I've been kind of pounding the pavement here pretty hard the last couple of weeks. Any word from on my paperwork or anything?
Yes. John had a relapse. And he's been in the hospital once today, once yesterday. Give me a call tomorrow and... I did talk to him today. He was sounding much better. Give me a call tomorrow, and I'll see if we can't get a few minutes in front of him, okay?
That would be absolutely super great. So appreciate you like normal. I always encourage with your calls and your knowledge. Have a good one.
Thank you. Thank you. You too, sir. Anyone else, press star 2 on your keypad, please. Raise your hand. Otherwise, we'll call it a night. It's all up to you. We'll go as long as you want to go. So we have... For Faro in Greensboro, North Carolina. Welcome.
It's Raven, and that's my former married name.
Raven.
So my question is, when the global currency reset takes place, what happens to all the fiat money that we have in different banks and whatnot?
I have no clue. Supposedly, now first off, we have to and we must insist upon remembering, we have to discipline ourselves that you will hear anything and everything from anybody, and nobody knows what tomorrow brings. There's speculation only. And based upon the evidence at hand, we govern ourselves accordingly with the best that we can. We trust up ourselves as much as possible so that we're insulated and isolated from anything that happened. But the allegation or the thought is is that when global currency reset takes place, the fiat money will be exchanged in notes. Instead of Federal Reserve notes, they will be United States notes. I don't know what the equivalent would be for Canada or any of the other countries, but they will be then backed by precious metals and other assets, as opposed to being backed by just the, quote, good faith and credit, end quote. That's my understanding.
Okay. And suppose we have it out of the country, like, say, in Panama or Belize.
Well, the denomination of U.S. dollars or French francs or Swiss credits, whatever they are, wherever they are, they're going to rise and fall in value as currencies always do. That's why you have currency traders. Won't matter that you're in Panama.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Sure. Now, the value for being in Panama for the purpose of this call is that you're outside of the Internal Revenue Code and you're outside of the United States Code. Now, this is really going to put a grin on some people's face. Within the freely associated compact states, you're also outside the United States of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. But that's a fight in court that you'll have to mess with. Versus if it's in Panama, you're able to easily operate internationally and you're outside the scope of the United States and the Internal Revenue Service. Any other questions, Raven?
No, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And then lastly here, we go with Brother Norman. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, Michael. First thing, you mentioned a relapse. That sounded like somebody had been sick. I pray to the Almighty it's not the judge.
No, it was not the judge.
Okay. Second thing is... Sorry I couldn't get on that Zoom call with you. I think it was Sunday night at 6, but I don't know what happened. It just wouldn't connect, but nevertheless, I tried.
I barely got connected.
You don't have a recording of that, do you?
Actually, I believe there is a recording, and it's on YouTube. So send me an email or text requesting a copy of that. I'll find it and get it to you.
Okay, good enough. And regarding the last person you asked about the fiat currency, actually the exchange is going to be mostly digital, so it's all internal, the O's and ones in the banks and the Federal Reserve. So as far as paper money, it really doesn't make much difference initially, right?
I would think so.
Okay.
But again, it's all speculation. Nobody knows. Thank you, sir. Next is New York City, ending in 1963.
Hello, this is Shelley in New York. Thank you for taking my call. I know you want to get off the air, but I just had a question regarding jurisdiction, which was very confusing to me because... my grandmother's grandfather was born in 1759, and he was the last surviving veteran to receive a pension for the American Revolutionary War. I've also discovered I'm Lenape Native American. So where would that put me in the scheme of things?
Well, by birthright, you would be. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. By birthright, you are one of the co-sovereignties that formed the country of the United States of America, a constitution for the United States of America. You're one of the – you join me. My great-grandfather, eight times removed, was named Nathaniel, and he fought not only did he fight in the War for Independence, he also fought in the War of 1812 under the Massachusetts Militia. So
my great great grandfather is Daniel. Daniel Bateman. It's online. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
So is there any other questions?
Thank you so much. Thank you.
welcome. Portia is next.
Hi, good evening.
Go ahead, Ms. Portia.
Thank you so much for your knowledge and everything you guys are doing. It's so wonderful. I really appreciate the lesson in this Babylonian system of government that we are subject to with their Roman Civil War. It's really refreshing to know there are
right.
so many people like you out there and that we are partnering to make a difference in this world with everything that's going on. My question is, if you already have a trust, irrevocable trust already set up and established, would we still need to obtain the one from you, or would we be able to go directly into the corporate soul?
No. The a revocable trust, an irrevocable spendthrift trust, a non-grantor trust, all of those are statutory trusts. They're all civil trusts. And no matter what the salesperson told you,
mm-hmm.
and I came across someone today who is selling revocable trusts, claiming that there'll be no tax associated with it, they're wrong. Because even though they may get the CP-575E letter from the IRS saying it's a non-taxpayer, being revocable, being irrevocable, being any kind of a trust, other than a religious trust, it will have a tax consequence somewhere. And it will be open to litigation. You see, a charitable religious trust is under ecclesiastical law. It is not subject to civil litigation, providing two tenets are not broken. You cannot operate a criminal enterprise through it. That'll bring them right in. You cannot commingle taxable income with the money that's in the charitable religious trust. That's the only two things. You keep those two things clear, and you'll never be able to bring in the civil law against you.
Very good. So
okay.
I think you touched on this before, yes. So even an irrevocable is for the purpose of the pending deal with Mike G, I guess we can temporarily have the funds transferred into the irrevocable trust until we establish religious trust.
If you do that, it'll be taxed, 37%.
It still will be taxed. Fascinating. Okay.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you so much for that clarification. I appreciate your help.
Okay. And I would love to have whoever is the author, and I know who they are, I would love to have them on a call with Judge Bernie and mm-hmm. let the two of them discuss it maturely and rationally and peacefully
mm-hmm.
Why it's claimed that a revocable or an irrevocable trust it cannot be taxed or will not be taxed. Explain it mm-hmm. by using the law, not mm-hmm. by what they got to say, but by using the law. We got people that will tell you that foreign currency, when it's exchanged, won't have a taxable consequence. I've asked for 10 years for people to put my finger on the law that makes that so. Nobody has yet to do it. They just keep repeating the mantra, well, it's mm-hmm. just an exchange, and it's not true. I can put your finger on the Internal Revenue Code that says that it's capital gains at 37%.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know about that. Oh, that's very troubling. So many of us got this trust with the expectation, so it's very troubling.
I know.
So we have to make haste and make some other arrangements. Well, thank you for the clarification. I'm very glad for your knowledge and for everything you're bringing to us.
My pleasure. Again, everybody, my phone number is 1-800-625-4250. 1-800-625-4250. When you call, spell out your first name, spell out your family name, then spell out your email address. I will get a welcome packet to you. You're not under any requirements to do anything with it other than I just asked you to read it, because two of those attachments in the welcome packet for Judge Bernie will put your finger on the law that says, that shows you why Judge Burney's charitable religious trust and the corporation soul that he helps you acquire is tax neutral. And as long as you keep those two stipulations clear, you'll never have a problem. And that's explained in the law there. One more question, and then we're going to call it a night.
Can I ask one more question, please? Yeah,
sure, Portia. Then we'll go to Georgia.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. On the religious trust, is the EIN number starting with a specific letter, specific number, like a 86 number or something to that effect?
No.
Do you know?
No.
No.
No. The when you get your EIN number, it comes on an IRS form, CP-575. And then following the CP-575 will be a single letter.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Okay. But again, remember, just because somebody followed the path that generated that CP-575E or G letter doesn't mean that the corpus, the body of the instrument that petitioned for that EIN number, is going to survive scrutiny. And if it's any kind of a trust other than a religious trust, it won't.
Understood. Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And our last caller for this evening is the Northeast Atlanta area ending in 4058. May I have your first name only, please?
Yes, my name is Dee. Can you hear me good?
Hey, I hear you, Dee.
Hello. Okay. I just have a couple of questions. One question is, when the trust is formed, the religious trust is formed, that's just the entity for asset protection, but where are the funds being held?
Well, the charitable religious trust will receive an EIN number. Part of the package is you'll go to the IRS website. You have step-by-step instructions on how to get the EIN for that charitable religious trust. Now, with the charitable religious trusts in your hand, the paperwork, if you would, the EIN number, the paper printed from the IRS website that says CP-575E, et cetera, that also has the EIN number on it, you take those documents into your bank and you say, I'd like to open up a checking account. I am the trustee for this trust, and would you please help me open this checking account? 40, 50, 60% of the time, I give that span because it's the way it works, 40, 50, 60% of the time, you'll be out the door in 20, 25 minutes with your checking account. Conversely, 40, 50, 60% of the time, they will tell you that it's unacceptable that they can't open the account. This is based on the lack of knowledge that the banker has. It has nothing to do with the paperwork itself. So I just want to let you know that up front.
Okay, if that happens, then do I try a different bank?
Yeah, that's all you do.
We had, it was real, when I first was
working with Bernie on this 8 years ago, we had this sweet, sweet man. And when I say he was a sweet man, you could tell by his language, his speech pattern, et cetera, that he was a spiritual man. Let's just leave it at that. He was a pastor, and he was doing this charitable religious trust, the corporation soul, for all the right reasons. He went to the first bank. They told him he was crazy. Went to the second bank, and it was basically the same thing. He calls us. What do I do? Bernie says, well, just go to the third bank. Third bank, he's there in the office. He calls Bernie. The guy in the third bank tells Bernie that he's a crook and a fraud selling scam trusts. That's what he's telling. And it goes on. By the fifth time he was in to a bank, this pastor, I could tell in talking with him, he was ready to talk to me like a longshoreman. It was that frustrating. But measured with his peace, he went into the sixth bank. In the sixth bank, he was out in 20 minutes. It has to do, everything has to do with the knowledge base of the people that you're talking to. And then they'll tell you, well, we sent this to our legal department. You know what? I think the legal department is in the men's bathroom at the bank or in the coffee shop, whatever. Because you'll
go to
the same bank but a different branch. And in fact, the bank that he ended up getting his account in was the same bank but a different branch of the first and the third bank that he went to.
Okay.
So it's the branch people and nothing else. It's their egos. Some of them basically have a deity complex, from my opinion.
Okay, and sorry about that. And the other question I have is, okay, now how will I, do I have restrictions on using my funds?
None.
The
only restriction is, remember the two stipulations. You cannot engage in criminal activity. So if you're using your funds to support criminal activity, yeah, you're going to have a problem, because that then breached the wall between civil and church law. So yeah,
okay.
You'd have a problem if you finance criminal activity. And you'd have a problem if you commingled taxable money with non-taxable money. Taxable money is, let's say that you've always worked in the flower industry. You're a florist. And it's your passion. And even though you've got more money than you know what to do with now, you still want to operate a florist shop or work for a florist. So you get your paycheck. Never deposit your paycheck into this account. That's all. Just keep it in an account under your Social Security number. That's all.
So I can purchase real estate. Now, when I purchase real estate or a house or whatever, then it does fall under, you know, I'll still have to pay my taxes on the house. Correct? I mean, that doesn't, you know, negate
yes
having
no.
to pay taxes.
Yes and all right. Let's talk about that a second. Yes and no. Yes. On the first blush, yes, you'll still have to pay your taxes. Why? Because even though the federal government, under the EIN number, the IRS will leave you alone because you have the proper paperwork and you're operating it properly, i.e. you're not violating the two tenets we talked about. The state government, the local property appraiser, is looking at your property as something that is on their land.
Right.
Land is one thing. A land tax is one thing. A property tax is another thing. A property tax can only happen on federal land. So if you live in Georgia, let's say Atlanta, Georgia, your property appraiser believes that that's federal land, not Georgia, one of the several states within the freely associated compact states. He believes that that's
right.
federal land. And that's the only way that they can tax the land, is because they own it and you're just a tenant on it. Now, you bought
right.
your house
right.
outright.
Right.
But if you ever looked at the deed says that you're a tenant. Why doesn't it say you're the
right.
owner?
Right.
Okay, so PJ has a separate program wherein you can go in through a series of letter writings, and in fact we have people on the call here that PJ is working that through for them, where the tax assessor will learn that the land in your case is Georgia, one of the freely associated compact states, and not the state of Georgia, a federal territory.
Awesome. Okay, I have just one more question. Okay, so when I do purchase the home...
No, as many as you want.
Right, when I do... if I purchase one home, will that home be under the name of the trust? Is that how I'm going to be purchasing it, or will it be under my name?
No, it'll be the trust name. You don't own it. You're
right.
the trust owner.
Okay.
You're not even the trustee anymore. The corporation's soul is the trustee. You're the manager of the corporation's soul. So you still control everything, but you own nothing.
Okay, no, I didn't want to confuse. So corporation soul, I thought the corporation soul and then religious trust is separate. They're not separate. They're one and the same. They're
they
together.
Are.
Oh,
no,
okay.
They're separate.
Yeah.
The trust
okay, so well,
insulates and isolates land. In your case, it insulates and isolates the land. And okay. Most people become the trustee themselves first simply because of finances. They don't have the $8,000 to acquire the corporation's soul. But as soon as they do, let's take this step by step. You acquire the trust. You get in the email, you'll get three attachments that say notarize immediately. One attachment is you accepting the position of trustee. The second attachment is you gifting the property into the trust. The third attachment, in Michael G's case, is you notifying Michael G that you no longer are the owner and holder of the note, that ABC Trust is now the owner and holder of the note, and you again notarized so that when he cuts a check for $500K, he doesn't cut the check to D, he cuts it to ABC Trust under an EIN number that the IRS recognizes as a non-taxpayer. You're good to go.
Okay, I see.
Now that you've
got
that money in the account, the next thing that you do is you overnight or wire $10,000 to Bernie for the corporation's soul, the work on the corporation's soul. And as soon as that becomes viable, you retire as the trustee. The successor trustee is the corporation's soul.
Okay, so there are definitely two. The religious trust is how I would initially have the account to receive the money, and then we have to create also the corporation soul to make me the trustee.
To be the trustee, yeah. The property doesn't go into the corporation soul. The corporation soul is simply the trustee. You were the trustee.
Okay.
Now the corporation soul is the trustee.
Okay. Okay, so then the corporation, so me being the trustee, that's underneath the umbrella of the religious trust. Is that correct?
Yes. The charitable religious trust is under the corporation soul.
Okay, got it. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Right. Thank you. Glad. Anything else, Dee?
No, that's all.
Very good. Thank you. I believe Portia has raised her hand one more time. She's going to be our last caller. Go ahead, Portia. Unmute your phone, Portia.
Okay. Sorry. Here I am. Sorry. Okay. Thank you again. I thought of this. We were told if we deposit the funds into a trust account that we established, under, I think it's Article 412, you know, as lawful money, it's eluding me now. Yes, I think it's 12411, that's it, 12411. And if we deposit it as lawful money, then that's how it becomes a non-taxable deposit.
Lawful money, constitutional money is gold and silver. So unless Michael G. is sending you an armored truck with a wheelbarrow full of gold or silver, you're not dealing in lawful money. Money wired in, money coming in wheelbarrows of cash, is not constitutional money. It's actually military script printed by the Internal Revenue Service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Please, do your due diligence. And go to people that talk to you to begin with to get you to get the revocable or irrevocable trust, whatever. Invite them on the Saturday call. I'd love to host that. And again, we'll be gentlemen going back and forth with the law. That's all that matters is what the law says. It doesn't matter what anybody's opinion is, okay?
Yes, of course. You know, it's my understanding that you're coming in on you know, this is on the private side instead of on the central bank side of the dollar. I mean, the way it was explained to us, we're coming in more on the United States Treasury, which is, you know, completely different. In terms of your tax liability.
It's a great story, Portia. It's a great story.
Yes, but like you said, we have to do our due diligence. I did look into all of this difference between legal tender and actual lawful money under the Article 12 of 411.
So, okay.
But okay, well, it's learned. Thank you again. I'll let you guys go. Thank you.
I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Thank you, Portia, and all the other, Shelley, all the other nice people that joined us. We'll return. Now, just to let you know, we have a phone recording that goes on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday on different topics. And you should at least sit and listen to the recordings on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday at least once. Or twice, just to get the flavor of what these other services are. We no longer do them for live calls. We do Tuesday live, we do Saturday live with Bernie. So just to listen to the other calls, get a feel. Our group has kept over 220 homes into quiet title that were in foreclosure. We haven't lost a credit card case in 15 years. And we've kept millions, hundreds of millions, possibly billions of dollars. I don't know what the number – well, actually, it is billions of dollars because two cases, one in Las Vegas and one in Los Angeles, were property tax cases, not internal revenue, property tax. Local governments raised the property taxes in a specific area of the town for the purpose of – outpricing the people that own the land that they wanted to have for future development and growth for the city. And that they did this crime back in 1975. The lawsuit didn't start until 2005. It was through one of the people that are one of our information providers that work through PJ, work with PJ, that you heard earlier tonight. And the settlement was in the billions. Both in Las Vegas and in Los Angeles. So welcome to next Tuesday for more. See you Saturday, prayerfully. Same phone number, same PIN, same time. Until then, I want to say goodnight, everybody. Thank you, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.